good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of a Pen and a Napkin podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to our interview series. Can't talk all of a sudden. And I am thrilled to have a former NBA coach, just a basketball coach's basketball coach, if you will, Stan Van Gundy, here on the pod today. Coach and I connected on a different project earlier this summer that I'm still working on and getting that figured out, and but that will come at some point. But I'm really thrilled for Coach Van Gundy coming on the 5-year anniversary podcast here today. Before we get to Coach Van Gundy, of course, we need to thank our founding sponsor. Without any of this 5 years ago, none of this would have happened. Cosac Chiropractic, Dr. Kevin, Dr. Heidi, thank you so very, very much for what you did for me and getting this off the ground. Coaches, if you are in the Omaha area and if you or any of your athletes are struggling with balance, neck, or spinal issues, go see Dr. Kevin or Dr. Heidi at 144th and Maple Street here in Omaha. Follow us on A Pen and a Napkin. We try to put out daily coaching tidbits on the Twitter handle, so be sure to follow us there. If you're listening, download, rate, review, iTunes, Spotify, whatever it may, give us 5 stars. Just, you know, put out good things about A Pen and a Napkin. Questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Enough of that stuff. Coach Stan Van Gundy, how are you doing this fine afternoon?
I am doing fine, Marty.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. Excited to have you on here. You know, we're, I don't think there's any, you know, normally you just have folks kind of give a little bit of background on themselves. But I think folks are pretty familiar with you and your work. So I think we're just going to dive right into it, Coach, if that's all right with you.
Sounds good.
All right. Obviously, you come from a basketball family, Stan. Through this other project, I got a chance to talk to your brother. I got a chance to talk to your dad a couple of times. Had a lot of fun with him. Let's start with Bill. Obviously, he's had a huge influence on you and Jeff. Just kind of tell his story for the folks that don't know a lot about his story and kind of his influence and how you guys grew up in the game.
Well, my dad started as a high school coach in 1959.
Okay.
In California, and that was the year that that I was born. Mm-hmm. And so I really, and Jeff too, neither one of us grew up knowing anything different other than coaching. I mean, we were just always around it. And not only his games and his practices, but, you know, so many of his friends were coaches. So there were coaches at the house, or we were over to lunch at another coach's house. And not all just basketball coaches. He was just, my dad is somebody who has great affection and great, great respect for coaches at every single level and what they go through. And so, you know, we just grew up to have that same respect for the profession of coaching, and also to see my dad's enthusiasm and passion for coaching and for the game of basketball. So I really, looking back, it's really not very surprising that we both ended up in the profession.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever a time, you know, as your dad grew in the game and, you know, kind of became a little bit more prominent and networked his way through things like through Snow Valley and different things like that, was there ever a time where you're like, wow, I can't believe my dad is friends with blank, you know?
I don't remember that feeling at all, Marty,
okay,
because, you know, we just sort of, it was sort of normal to just be around coaches. And I think that the one thing is, with my dad, you know, my dad was never a guy that was very wrapped up in level or status.
Mm-hmm.
Or any of that. He was, it was truly pure. It was about coaching, getting better at coaching, the game itself. And the people who did it, and not, my dad was never overly impressed, like, oh, the guy's a big time college coach, or the big guy's an NBA coach. Like, yeah. You were a coach, and you know, he had respect for that, but no more so for anyone at higher level than he had for guys that were at the high school level. So that was never a thing for us. I think we were both just used to being around the game. I do remember, you know, especially as we got older, thinking, wow, my dad's got a really cool job, you know. It was, I guess, I was going into maybe the fourth grade, I think, when my dad went into the college coaching as an assistant at St. Mary's College in California. And I do remember thinking, wow, this is pretty cool. Like, you know, we get to go to, first of all, I mean, I don't care what the job is, what kid would not like to get a chance to go to work with his dad? I mean, I remember being at practices and games and around the athlete. That's the stuff that, you know, was really cool. I mean, you're a little kid and, you know, you're around high school athletes and then college athletes. I mean, it was fantastic, and other coaches. And yeah, I mean, it was very, very exciting and a very cool thing to be around.
Yeah. You know, and when I talked to your dad about the project that you and I talked about earlier this summer, we ended up talking two or three different times, and yeah, he was just so genuine, so salt of the earth. And he was just, he's about 88 or 89, Stan?
Just turned 89 years old. Yeah.
And he was still just as excited to talk about coaching today as he probably ever has been. And it was just a lot of fun. I really enjoyed the conversations that we had. So you could just tell that enthusiasm bubbles over in him, you know?
Well, I mean, he always felt that and would say all the time that, you know, he never worked a day in his life, you know, and that's the way he felt. And so I think as a kid, you're growing up and your dad enjoys his job that much. And then you get to be around it. I mean, I think, you know, going into the family business, so to speak, becomes very, very natural. And quite honestly, I mean, just a tremendous, you know, leg up for my brother and I. I mean, we were just so lucky. Because we've literally been around the game our entire lives, and learning from him and from the coaches he was friends with. I mean, you were just always around the game. I mean, I've been going to practices since before I started school, you know, and you had an idea of what that looked like. And, you know, you watched your dad at practice. You watched your dad in the locker room before the games. You watched your dad on the bench and in timeouts. And, you know, I mean, you just had the, you know, the privilege of seeing that up close for your entire life. I mean, we had such an advantage over most other people who go into coaching, who maybe have a high school coach or a college coach, who inspires them to go into it, which is great, but they don't necessarily get to learn like we did. And so I've known every day of my coaching career how lucky I was and how advantaged I was to have had the upbringing just in general, but in coaching that I had.
Well, speaking of you and speaking of Jeff, he's, you know, he was always kind of at the edges of things while he was, you know, doing the announcing for ABC and ESPN. I know he'd done some Team USA stuff, but you know, how happy are you for you just got to be thrilled. I shouldn't say that. I don't have to ask you how happy you are, but you got to be thrilled for Jeff and his journey. You know, about a year, you know, a little over a year ago, had real disappointing news from ESPN and ABC. Now he goes to the Olympics, wins a gold medal, part of that staff. He's heading out to training camp here with the Clippers. What a difference a year makes, and you just got to be thrilled for your brother.
Well, absolutely. And the thing with Jeff is all those years as a broadcaster, 17, I believe, and, you know, the best in the business. I don't think too many people would argue that, but he never quit being a coach ever in that time. I mean, he thought about coaching virtually every single day, and was always looking at the game as a coach. And so this, I think, you know, it'll be great for him to be back out on the floor, but to me, he was always a coach. He was just behind the microphone for 17 years. And in a lot of ways there, coaching everyone who was watching. I mean, I think he gave everyone a little bit of an insight to how coaches think. I've had so many people over the past year, you know, text me, and a lot of them coaches, and text me and tell me how much they missed hearing him on broadcast. Had a couple of people that said, you know, every time your brother was on, I made sure I had a notepad nearby when I was watching the game.
Yep.
So, he's always been a coach. He's always thought like a coach, and this will be a natural transition back into it for him.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got your start really, really young. You know, a lot of folks think of the stops you had in the NBA and at Wisconsin. We'll talk about that here in just a little bit, but you actually started out as a head coach at 24 years old at Castleton State, kind of fresh out of college, ready to go. I mean, what was that experience like for you, Stan?
Well, I had 2 years right out of college. I was really lucky. I had 2 years as an assistant at the University of Vermont. And the way that I was able to get that job, we only had two assistants. One was full-time, but he had to also teach.
Uh-huh.
Vermont wasn't really funding their program like they are now. And then I got the second job, and I basically got grad assistant type salary. I mean, I got graduate credit. I got a very small stipend. I got free meals in the dining hall, and that was it.
Yep.
But the good part of that is I got a chance to be a Division I assistant because of that. Had Vermont paid like they are paying now, I wouldn't have gotten nearly the level of responsibility that I had there. And one of the things my dad told me when I was coming out of college and looking at jobs, and I had a couple of choices, and he would always tell me when I was young and single, and he said, take responsibility over money. Like, you don't need that much to live on, and, you know, you need a chance to do things. And I did that. And then the similar opportunity came up at Castleton State College in Vermont, Division III and NAIA school. We played NAIA in the tournaments, but we were Division III, also NCAA, so no scholarships. And that job at the time, it was 1983. And it was paying $7,500 a year to be the equipment manager and $1,500 a year to be the head coach of their basketball team. And so I took that over an opportunity to go as a full-time assistant to Dartmouth College at five or six times the money. You know, again, with my dad's thing, hey, you want to coach? You got a chance to be a head coach at 24, you know, go and run with it. Like, you know, you don't need money. I mean, later in life, you'll need money. You don't need money. You know, and so look, my dad had a huge influence on my career in so many ways, not only what I learned, but, you know, I was just telling people at a coaching clinic the other day, I think one of the things we all need as coaches, and probably just as people, we need people in our lives who will tell us the truth.
Absolutely.
And I remember 2 months after having the Castleton job, you know, I was complaining, the paychecks. I mean, man, like, you know, they were small. And I was like, man, I'm having trouble here. And I was complaining a little bit. And he was on the phone and he said, Stan, you know, just remember, if they paid more money, you wouldn't have gotten the job. You know, and that's
wise words. Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah.
But it's absolutely true because the pool of candidates were people that could take the job at that amount of money. And I was very, very lucky to have it. And then later on in that year, I mean, I inherited the other fortunate thing there is I just inherited a really talented small college basketball team. And I didn't know how talented. I mean, this was, you know, 1983. It's not like I could get the job and then had all this film available.
Yep.
There was literally none available. I asked the athletic director. They didn't have anything. I mean, I had no film. So, you know, they've won 14 games. They were 14 and 13, I want to say, the year before I got there. You know, and I remember going into the gym the first week of school and guys got together. We'd had our preseason meeting and laid out our conditioning program, but I hadn't seen anybody play. I remember going in and, you know, sitting on the stage. We still had a gym as a small college team with the stage at the other end.
Beautiful.
And I remember sitting up there with my assistant coach and watching guys play pickup games. And I was only 2 years removed from having been a Division III player. So I knew what the Division III level was all about. I watched them play for less than an hour, Marty. And I looked at my assistant coach and I said, holy crap. I mean, we've got talent. Like, we've got a chance.
We got dudes real that are going to make me look smarter than what I really am.
Oh my God, we got a chance to be really, really good. And we won in the first semester at school, you know, the Division III school normally take a little bit of a break around Christmas time because y'all have the money to pay for your guys to be there when school's not in session. So we get to the semester break. We were 8-0 and had not called a timeout and had beaten in that 8-0 stretch two of the top five teams in Division III basketball, of Sala College in New Jersey and Potsdam State in New York. I mean, we were loaded.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the break, we lost our first and third leading scorers to eligibility problems.
Oh, geez.
And then won 18 straight games before losing in our district final. We were just absolutely loaded. And I was so fortunate. And a great group of guys. To the point of, and this is what I try to tell people and players, like, you got to understand what it's all about. And not just at the small college level, but anywhere. If you really do team sports right, if you give in to the team, if you're more about the team than yourself, this is a lifelong thing. And, you know, 10 of those guys that I coached at that school, I coached here 3 years, came down in April and spent Final Four weekend down here in Florida with me, flew in from all over the country, and we're here, and we watched the men's Final Four games and the women's Final Four games. Those guys are still best friends 40 years in. I mean, awesome. It was such a close group, and it's what it's all about, and it's because nobody cares, you know, 40 years later, who was the leading scorer and who averaged what, who played more. You know, I tell kids all the time, like, you think it's all about playing time and the number of shots you get. And I'm just telling you, I know for sure being around these guys, they taught me that's not what it's all about. It's about giving everything to the team and the team gives everything back to you. I mean, it's been an amazing experience, and that's, you know, what I have seen throughout my career and the relationships I've been lucky enough to have.
Coaches, if you are in the Omaha, Council Bluffs, Lincoln metropolitan areas and surrounding areas, It is that time of year again. It is time for the 2024 MBCA Fall Coaches Clinic Series. We're going to start this on Wednesday, September 18th. We're going to go 4 weeks in a row, September 18th, 25th, October the 2nd, and October the 9th. And we have got a great lineup of coaches. Drew Johnson, women's basketball coach at Nebraska Kearney. Marty Levinson, new men's basketball coach at Nebraska Kearney. Tim Sandquist, head men's basketball coach at Kirkwood Community College. Carrie Amy, the new women's basketball coach at the University of South Dakota. Mark Swoboda, from my alma mater, Briarcliff University. Go Chargers, head men's basketball coach there. Coach Swoboda is going to be down. Amy Williams, head women's basketball coach at the University of Nebraska, is going to be one of our guests. We've got a couple more slots to fill. So it is going to be a great series of clinics. It's going to be located at Legends Sports Bar here in Omaha, 72nd and Pacific Street, just east of 72nd Street there. And for those four clinics, $80 is going to cover your clinic fees, the beverages, the food, and the camaraderie, the networking, all of those different things you're going to have at the Metro Basketball Coaches Association Coaches Clinics here this fall series. It's going to be a great run of coaches, so I encourage you, get signed up today. If you want to get signed up, if you want more information, you can send an email to Tom Crable at mbcaomaha@gmail.com. And Tom will get back to you. He'll get you all the information that you need. So coaches, get signed up for this fall's run of coaches clinics for the Metro Basketball Coaches Association. Well, let's talk about your career a little bit here, coach. You had, other than Castleton, which, you know, some, you know, a lot of people would consider that a quote unquote big time stop, but you've coached at five, what we'll call high profile places, a Big Ten school, and then four stops in the NBA. So, let's go rapid fire here just real quick. And we'll go in chronological order here. So we'll start with Wisconsin. What is, from what you remember from each one of these stops, what's one big thing that you learned from each job? And let's start with Wisconsin.
Well, Wisconsin, we struggled a little bit more than we should have with good talent. And the thing I really learned there is I went in and I had some ideas and tried to do some things that I hadn't ever coached. Mm-hmm. And I think that set us back. I think you can do those things and try some things you haven't coached before when you've established your program and the core beliefs in what you have and everything else, and had some success where you've earned the confidence of the players and everything else. But mm-hmm. to do it there was not smart and was not good. And we recovered and had some good games that year, but did not play as well as we should have. And I ended up getting fired in 1 year. And, you know, I learned you got to know what you're doing, so to speak. And I don't mean just intelligence-wise. Like, you get into jobs like that, you know, you have to have taught the stuff and really understand what you're doing and what you're familiar with. And then you can start incorporating other things as seasons go on at a place. So that stuck with me.
Mm-hmm. Miami.
I mean, what I really learned there was in my first year was, you know, to just have a real strength and a real will, and when you believe in something, to stick with it and be persistent. We started that year, my first year. I got the job at the end of training camp. So Pat yep. Riley was still the head coach through training camp.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and I got the job at the end. And so we started the year 0-7. We were 5-15 at one point, and then we ended up sort of playing 500 for a long time, but we were still 11 games under 500 heading into March. And then we won 17 of our last 21 games to get to the playoffs, won a first round series, got to the second round, and had good talent, Dwayne Wade, rookie year.
Yep.
And guys just continued to get better. And we were, you know, just persistent in our daily routine. I wasn't as positive probably as I should have been throughout the year, but I had a great staff and Eric Spoelstra, Bob McAdoo, Keith Askins that,
yep,
you know, buoyed me through the year. And we just kept plugging away. And guys got a lot better as time went on, and we got better as a team. And then the next year, you know, expectations went way up. We got Shaquille O'Neal in the whole thing, and obviously had to make a change in the way we played around him. We were great. We won 59 games. We went in as the number one seed, and lost game seven in the Eastern Conference Finals at home. Still one of the most disappointing losses of my career. Dwayne Wade missed game six. We lost in Detroit with clinch a series. He did not play in that and was played hurt in game seven. And the thing I learned there was, you know, it's probably the most belief in myself I ever had, because I hit a lot of criticism after game seven, you know, and some of it from inside, which wasn't a lot of fun. But,
sure,
you know, I think I've always been able to evaluate myself fairly and usually harshly. But I look back on especially game seven and decisions down the stretch and said, no, give me the same game again. I'm going with the same thing. We're going to get the same shot and we're going to make it,
yep,
you know? So,
yep.
I think the one, you know, if you want to put that really in context, I think what I learned there is you can't just judge everything by results. I mean, that's, yep, what the media and fans do, and more power to them, but you can't do that as a coach.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. It's about the process. And, you know, you just have games, you know, what do they say about the NBA all the time? It's a miss or make league. And if you make shots, you look great. And if you miss shots, you don't look as well. And heck, that's all you can do. That's all you can control. And it's not like any of those guys that missed shots down the stretch. It wasn't like they were like, man, I can't wait to brick this thing. You know, I can't wait to just break the backboard or whatever it may be. You know, it's just stuff happens, and you're playing a great team. I mean, those Detroit teams went to the conference finals, what, 4 or 5 years in a row?
Oh, and
won a championship.
Yeah, they were the defending champions, yep, when we lost them. But you know what? You've also got to be able to go the other way, I think. I think being able to face reality and face truth and fairly evaluate yourself is a big part of any job, but certainly in coaching. And sometimes it's the other way, too. You come out with a win, sometimes even big win. But if you really look back, you know, a great player bailed you out, or, you know, a lucky shot went in and you made a lot of mistakes. And I think I've learned that over the course of my career. You know, I've learned how to sort that out a little bit and say, you know what, we didn't do a real good job tonight,
mm-hmm,
or we haven't been doing a good job over the last 2 weeks, but I've got Dwayne Wade, or, you know, I've got a Dwight Howard or a Rashard Lewis or a Hedo Turkoglu, and they bailed us out.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't do the best job we could do. And so I think you've got to try in your evaluation process to divorce yourself from the results a little bit.
Yep, yep. How about Orlando?
Well, you know, in Orlando, the lesson was really, and I think I've known this for a long time, but I think that it really tied together for me, is as a coach, you've got to figure out how to get your best players on the floor. And I think that's happening more and more now in the NBA, where the game has, quote, become positionless. But at the time, when I got the job in Orlando in 2007, I mean, it was still primarily, people might go small at the end of games, but it was still primarily that, you know, you had a point guard, a two guard, a small forward, especially a power forward and a center. And we took an injury to our starting power forward, Tony Battee, before the 2007-2008 season started. And as a result of that, we really didn't have a true NBA caliber starting power forward to go to. Mm-hmm. What we had was two of the best small forwards in the game in Rashard Lewis and Hedo Turkoglu.
Yep.
And so we just decided, well, we got to get our best players out there. We played them together. And I think us and the Suns at that time with Mike D'Antoni became really the first teams who started and played most of the game with 4 3-point shooters.
Yep.
Ours was by luck. Like, I get a lot of, no, it really was. I get a lot of credit, but I get a lot of credit for that, Marty. But had Tony Battee not gone down, I would have been probably playing those two guys as a two and a three.
Uh-huh.
I would have played them, but I don't think I would have come to the lineup that I did. You know, but I just think you've got to get your best players on the floor, regardless. It might be three small guards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might be four bigs. I thought J.B. Bickerstaff in Cleveland 3 years back, right, when he still had...
Oh, he started marketing at the three, yeah.
Yeah, exactly right, because those are his best players. And you have got to get your best players on the floor. And if it's three bigs, if it's Jared Allen, Mobley, and Lowry Markkanen, well, they've got to play together.
Yep.
You know, that's what you have to do to be successful. So that was the big lesson for me in Orlando.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I think, you know, and then the overall lesson both in Miami and Orlando is, and I think every coach needs to know this, I think we all do, but you've really got to know it, is, look, you're going to win games based on the talent that you have. Your job as a coach is to put them in the best positions you can, but you're not winning without talent. And in both those places, I had great, great talent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, your Orlando teams, when you played Turkoglu and Rashard Lewis together, the only other team that I kind of seen that, and I don't know if you even borrowed from the blueprint of this, Stan, was Rudy T's Houston teams, where he play Ori at the four and really spread it out there. That's, you know, those are the teams that was the team that your Orlando team reminded me of when I was watching you play during that stretch.
Yeah, I mean, it was what you saw most of the time with those teams, and including Houston's team, is you'd bring a guy off the bench in, mm-hmm. you know, in, I don't say desperation time, but as the game went on, I think that, you know, it's really weird to look back now, because we were always among the leaders and led the league at least once in three-point attempts in that time. And if you took the number of attempts we had then and looked at it today, we'd be right at the bottom of the league.
Mm-hmm. How about Detroit?
Detroit, more of the lessons I learned were personnel based and front office based. You know, I just think there that, you know, we didn't do a good enough job in the draft. People make draft choice mistakes at times.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is when you're coming from where we were, you know, where you're at the bottom of the league, we had come in, we had Detroit had lost more games in 5 years before we got there than any team in the East. And that includes Philadelphia, who was trying to lose back then.
Yeah, so, yeah, the process.
So we were, you know, we were in a difficult situation. And when you're down, you can't make the mistakes that I made. I think the mistakes there, I apologize for my dog. I have five of them right now, Marty, so because I got two of my daughters. Both a little crazy.
Yeah, those vicious beasts, I tell you.
But, what I learned about the personnel there is that you've really, as a coach, got to pay attention to the guys who can play for you and the guys you like, and you can't just get caught up in, just talent. Like, a guy might be a better player, but it's got to be fit and everything else. So, but I thought we made some really good moves in terms of the pro moves we made in terms of trades and things, but didn't do a good enough job in terms of roster construction. And that was there. That was under my purview. Looking back, the only other thing that I really learned coaching-wise is I thought we did a pretty good job. But in my last year there, we had a rookie, Luke Kennard, who we had drafted. Yep. And I played Luke. I brought him off the bench. He played significant minutes. But if I looked back on that, I think you've got to start the season with an idea of, as a coach, that these are going to be my best players at the end of the season. Mm-hmm. These are going to be the guys that over time are going to be my best players, and you got to have them play. Luke wasn't ready defensively at the time, and so I didn't play him enough. I really think had I put him in the starting lineup from day one with his skills and his smarts, that he would have eventually gotten there defensively. Mm-hmm. And we would have been a better team, and I think we would have been a playoff team. And I could still, that in the draft, I could probably still be in Detroit. So that was really the lesson there.
Yep, yep. Let's wrap up with New Orleans.
Well, it's funny because I said off the bat at Wisconsin, I learned that, you've got to go in and do what you know.
Yep.
And I went into New Orleans and I tried to make a significant change to what I've done defensively. In the time I'd been off and doing announcing, I had seen some things that I thought I could do better and that could change some very basic NBA things defensively. And basically just continue to play ball handlers and pick and roll straight up because so many people were slipping out of screens and things. And, that was the year. It was still the lockout year. It wasn't the bubble year. It was the year after. And so that was the year we started playing in front of no fans.
Yep, yep.
We got lit up from three in the first half of the year. We were terrible defensively. I'd never had a team that wasn't pretty good defensively. We were great offensively, but not good defensively. And when we went back to what I'd always known, we were a top 10 defensive team the second half of the year, but we were already too far behind the eight ball, and didn't end up making the playoffs. And I ended up getting fired in 1 year. So I learned that lesson, but I also, on the positive side, learned that you've got to, I didn't really learn, I knew this, it was a thought going in, but I think we showed it, is you've got to look at your best players and build around them and say, okay, what do they do best? And so we basically took Zion Williamson, second year in the league, he only played 24 games as a rookie, and as the year went on, we played him more and more and more as a point guard.
Yep.
We thought he was better with the ball. Steven Adams was our center, so not a guy who could space the floor. A backup center was Jackson Hayes, not a guy who could space the floor. We had a third center, Billy Hernan Gomez. None of them could space the floor. And so if you were going to play Zion as a conventional power forward, you were going to have spacing problems. You're going to have two non-shooters out there when everybody else had the ball. But if Zion had the ball in his hands, well, then you had three shooters and a guy down in the dumper spot you could play. So it fit Zion and our team, and we were very, very good offensively by taking a guy of Zion's size and basically handing him the reins as a point guard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The evolution into point Zion at the quote unquote three or four or whatever. And now, you know, he might be starting at center with the way they have the roster constructed now a couple of years later. So we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens there. So in 1993, Counting Crows referred to Omaha as somewhere in Middle America. More people know Omaha as the home of Warren Buffett, the Union Pacific Railroad, and the College World Series. Athletically, Nebraska is known for its dominance in college and high school football and volleyball, while basketball has perennially been on the back burner. But for one season, in its largest city, basketball was king of the state. In a time of social and political turmoil in our country, three high school boys basketball teams from Omaha, Nebraska were ranked in the top 25 in the country, featuring some of the best talent that one city has ever produced anywhere in the country. Amongst these three teams were nine Division I basketball players, and all 15 starters from these three teams played collegiate athletics at various levels for at least two seasons. Kings of their court, three teams, one city, and the greatest basketball season in Nebraska high school history begins with the chaotic ending of the 2020 state tournament as the whole world was shutting down due to the COVID-19 virus. Over the span of the next year, these players, coaches, and parents navigated their basketball futures while also, like the rest of the United States and the world, worked through COVID quarantines, the George Floyd murders and riots, the political turmoil of the 2020 presidential campaign, and much more. One year later, the destinies of these three teams would intertwine themselves for the final time at the 2021 Nebraska State Basketball Tournament, where the crescendo to this story occurred 365 days after it began, with some of the best high school basketball any state has ever seen. Kings of their court, three teams, one city, and the greatest basketball season in Nebraska high school history is the story of highly driven individuals searching to achieve lifelong dreams and aspirations, both on and off the basketball floor, during a season that almost didn't happen. Kings of Their Court will be published on October the 1st, Tuesday, October the 1st. Kindle copies are $9.99. Paperback copies are $19.99. Copies are eligible to be pre-ordered today, so be sure to get on Amazon.com and pre-order your copy of Kings of Their Court. Coach, we could go a lot of different directions here. You want to talk a little John Wooden? You want to talk a little announcing? You want to talk a little NBA storylines? What do you want to do, Stan?
Whatever you want to do, Mike.
Oh, that's a lot of pressure. Oh, boy.
It is a lot of pressure.
Let's do a quick John Wooden quote of the day. How about that? From Wooden, a lifetime of observations here. What we do every week, Coach, is we take I pick out a quote from the book, and I pop it out to the guest, and then we just, you know, kind of break it down and chew it up for a couple of minutes here. So, Coach Van Gundy, are you ready for the John Wooden quote of the day?
I am.
All right. The quote of the day is, a leader's most powerful ally is his or her own example. Leaders don't just talk about doing something, they do it. Swin Nader, a former player at UCLA, told me once, Coach, you walk the walk. He meant that I led by example. And that's from page 116. What do you think, Stan?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. You know, my brother, and he got this from somebody else, but he uses the quote all the time. You know, your actions speak so loudly, I can hardly hear what you're saying. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it's absolutely true. Look, the one thing I think even down to the high school level, and probably even younger than that, we don't sometimes give players enough credit for how smart they are. Like, this idea that you can just BS guys and, you know, tell them a lot of stuff that isn't true and they'll believe you. I don't think they buy that in the least. Like, they're looking to see what you can do. And I think one of the things that players are really looking at is you talk about the values that are important to you as a coach. They're going to look at how do those values apply to your best players.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said to high school coaches at a clinic in Houston this past weekend, I said, look, if you go in and tell them, like, hey, listen, everything we do, we're going to be on time, and I'm not going to tolerate guys getting left or guys being late. And then your first road game of the year, your best player's late to the bus, and you hold the bus, and he gets on the bus, and then you go over and play as if nothing happened.
Yep.
Well, players now know that being late is really not a problem for you.
Mm-hmm.
What your number one value is that we get our best players to the game, and that's fine. I don't have a problem with that, but you have to understand that's the actual lesson that you're teaching. And if we go back to John Wooden, my favorite story of all time with John Wooden, and I grew up in Northern California, huge UCLA fan, much to the chagrin of my dad, who was a Cal, he was a Cal graduate, a Pete Newell guy through and through.
You
had
bet.
Had nothing against Wooden,
yeah.
But his sons grew up as huge UCLA guys. My favorite story was to Bill Walton. I think it was the start of the senior year, maybe in his junior year.
I know which one you're going here. Yep.
He comes in the day before practice is supposed to start October 15th. And, you know, he didn't like Wooden's rule about having to be, you know, clean cut and clean shaven. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because he went all summer with the beard and the long hair, going to Grateful Dead concerts, the whole thing. And John Wooden said, well, Bill, do you really believe that strongly? And he said, yes, I do. And Wooden said, well, Bill, I really respect people who stand up for their principles, and the team's going to miss you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now, listen, I don't agree. I don't care. You know, we all have our different standards. The point of the story is John Wooden had his standards. And even for Bill Walton, quite possibly the best college player of all time, certainly one of the top three or four.
Yep.
John Wooden wasn't going to change his standard. And that's what I think Swin Nader means when he says, coach, you walk the walk. Like, you know, we all basically talk about the same things as coaches.
Yep.
We do. We talk about unselfishness and hard work and sacrifice and all these things. But players look and they don't get that same lesson from everybody. And it's because it's not the words that matter. It's how you operate as a coach. And they see different things from different people who are giving or saying probably the exact same words.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, along that as well, if your best player is pulling something like that, so to speak, the first game of the year, that's a bad sign for your team that your best player isn't engaged and ready to go. And there's a, not only is you're leaving that dude or dudette by the side of the road, but you're having a good conversation with that person, say, hey, look, we are not going to go anywhere without you being the example here. You don't have to be a great vocal leader, but if you're our best player, you have to at the very least lead by example. And that's what I talked about at a USA Gold Camp I was at last week, you know, or a couple weeks ago, was, hey, you don't have to be a verbal leader, but everybody can lead by example. And like, you know, Jeff was saying about your body language and your actions. And I think that's a conversation, you know, that if you're in that situation, you sit down with that player and you say, look, this isn't just going to work, not only for you on a personal level, but look at what you're doing to our team here. And if you really care about the team, you're going to get your stuff taken care of as well.
Well, and that's generally what it comes down to. If that best player, if that guy cares about the team, he will normally come around and do everything you want. Like, you can't, you'd be making a mistake as a coach, like you just said, Marty. You can't and shouldn't try to change guys' personality. Some guys are quiet. Some guys are rah-rah guys. You know, you can't change personality. But that guy's got to embody the values. So when you get to the NBA level, a little different than high school, when you get to the NBA level, there's all this talk of culture and everything else, and everybody wants to give coaches credit for that stuff. I don't buy it at all at the NBA level. At the NBA level, because the players are paid more than the coaches, they're more valuable than the coaches, all of those things, your culture is going to come down to your best player, period. They're going to decide. It's going to be good or bad. Now, you can try to moderate that a little bit. You certainly work hard to develop a relationship with those guys to sell them on your culture and so that you have some agreement. But at the end of the day, the best players on the team in the NBA are going to set your culture, not the head coach.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's do this, Stan. Let's dive into some NBA coaching storylines. And then we'll talk a little bit about your philosophy to wrap everything up. How's that sound?
That sounds good.
All right. So, and again, let's, you know, obviously you spend time announcing and analyzing the league and doing things like that. So I picked out four kind of questions here about NBA coaches and different things and kind of picking your brain here. Let's start with where everything apparently has to start with in the NBA. So I guess I'm guilty of it as well. And that's the Los Angeles Lakers and, of course, J.J. Redick coming in. Great player, you know, longtime vet, but obviously no real major coaching experience. And here he is with maybe perhaps the most glamorous job in the league, the head coach of the L.A. Lakers. From your point of view, what is the thing that JJ needs to be most urgent about this season in order to be successful with this particular team with the Los Angeles Lakers as currently constructed?
Well, look, I think it's probably true of a lot of NBA teams, but JJ's relationship with LeBron James and Anthony Davis and what he is going to be able to get them to do in terms of what he wants done on the court is going to be the key, because everybody on that team is going to follow those two guys.
Yep.
If those two guys buy into JJ Redick and his system, his philosophy, everyone else is going to buy in. If they don't, then you're going to have problems. And so I think that is going to be the key thing for him, like it is with every coach, particularly at the NBA level. I think the other thing that everybody's got to come to grips with in coaching, but particularly at the NBA level where the players are more powerful in everything, is, you know, how comfortable are you with conflict? Because you're not going to make decisions that everybody agrees with, even your best player, then you can't. And if you do, then you're not really making the decisions they are. And when you believe strongly in things, you're going to have to at some point take a stand and just say, this is the way it's going to be. And there's going to be conflict. It's one of the reasons I think that Eric Spoelstra's the best in the league. I think there's a lot of great coaches. But I think Eric, in a lot of situations, actually welcomes conflict. He thinks that it's good. I mean, it's a long season. You need something to sort of shake things up at times. Mm-hmm. And I think those two things, his relationships with his best players and, you know, his comfortability with conflict will show the way. And then also, you know, and I think JJ's a super, super smart guy. I think that he will look for help from a very experienced staff that he has, and I think he'll be fine.
Mm-hmm. Joe Mazzulla, how impressive was it to watch his quote-unquote turnaround last year. Now, a lot of people forget, I mean, he was kind of like in your situation when you were in Miami, where he was hired in training camp. We had the issue, you know, the issue with Ime the year before, and he's just kind of thrown to the fire, all those different things. How pleasing was it as a fellow coach to see him really turn around a lot of doubters and pull off the season that the Celtics did?
Well, look, I think the big thing with Joe, what Joe has is, and this is just observing from the outside, is Joe has tremendous belief in himself.
Yep.
And so through everyone else doubting him, Joe never doubted himself. That's for both years. Joe thought what he was doing was what was best for their team. He stuck with it. I think that and the fact that they had success, the players bought into what he was doing, and they didn't change a lot. You know, there were times where people, they shoot too many threes. They got to go to the basket more. They got to do this. They got to do that. Joe knew the way he wanted to play. He went and believed in his bench when a lot of people, me being one of them, didn't think that would be a strength. He empowered them. I think Joe's belief in what he does has been tremendous, and he's had great results.
Mm-hmm. Who's 1, 2, 3 coaches in the league that you have really enjoyed watching work, and why do you like watching them work?
Wow. I mean, there are just so many. I really like Mark Daigneault in Oklahoma City.
Yep.
The coach of the year. I've known Mark since he was an assistant at University of Florida with Billy Donovan. And I just think he's a great role model for coaches at any level, because Mark was not a high-profile guy, and he was a guy who just kept working, always about the team, kept learning, was never in any way a self-promoter. I mean, just put his head down, did his work.
Just a grinder.
Learned, you know, and he's got, obviously, great knowledge of the game. He's got a tremendous demeanor. He is firm in his belief in things without being a yeller and screamer, but certainly holds guys accountable. He is an outstanding teacher. Everything they do is well thought out and very, very solid. I just think Mark is outstanding, and a guy who's really, you know, he paid his dues and he spent his time, and I just think coaches at every level can learn from him. I think what Mark did, I don't think Mark focused much of his effort when he got into the business about thinking what his next job would be and how to get there. I think what Mark focused on was trying to become a better coach all the time. And so when his opportunity came, and let's just be honest, for everyone, the opportunity involved a lot of luck. Like you can't control that. But I know a lot of people who complain that they haven't gotten an opportunity, or they're jealous. Why'd that guy get a chance? And, you know, I've been paying my dues and I didn't get a chance. And then there's guys like Mark who just put their head down and keep getting better. And what they're more concerned about is being ready when their opportunity comes. And Mark was more than ready. He's done an unbelievable job with that young team. One of the hardest things I think to do in the NBA is to get a young team to be really, really good defensively. It takes so much knowledge, so much discipline, and they really just don't know what it's all about. And for Mark to have that team as one of the best defensive teams in the league, Jamal Mosley's done a similar thing in Orlando with super young guys. I mean, I just think that achievement is incredible by itself. But I really, really like Mark.
Mm-hmm. I gave you four names, four coaches in four different situations, and I screwed up on one, Stan, so I'm going to make this adjustment. So, but who kind of, in your mind, kind of faces kind of the biggest challenge? And all four of these guys face different challenges in different ways. You know, Doc Rivers in Milwaukee, a little bit of an aging roster, but made a couple of nice pickups, Gary Trent Jr., Tibbs in New York, you know, probably the probably since your brother was the coach of the Knicks, they haven't had this type of expectations coming into a season. Mike Malone in Denver. And then I put down Rick Carlisle, but what I meant to put down was Jason Kidd. You know, can he, you know, capture that lightning in a bottle again? Can they put it all together the same way they did at the end of the year there? That type of thing. Who do you think kind of faces the biggest challenge out of that group?
Well, I'll tell you what, that's quite a group, and they share one thing in common, in my opinion, is the expectations exceed the talent on their roster. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be hard for any of the four of those guys, and you just mentioned four of the best coaches in the NBA.
You bet.
I think it's going to be hard for any of the four of them to reach the expectations that fans and media have for them for very different reasons. New York's probably the best team of that group, but they're not as talented as Boston or Philadelphia, and so I still think that they struggle for them there. I think Dallas is in a really, really deep Western Conference, and so I think just being able to repeat and win that conference would be tough for anybody. I think that conference goes 10 people deep. So, yep. Or 10, I'm sorry, I misspoke. I mean, they're probably 12 to 13 teams deep. It won't even be easy for teams to make the play-in.
Yeah.
I would say that, you know, Doc Rivers, he's got two great names there with Giannis and Damian Lillard. I'm not a big fan of the rest of their roster. And again, New York, Boston, and Philly ahead of them, I don't see them as true contenders in the East, but the biggest challenge is with Michael Malone. I think, look, they won the championship, and then all they've done is lose parts of their rotation strength. They lost Bruce Brown and Jeff Green after the championship, and somehow were still very, very good. Lost in the second round to Minnesota, and you know, then they lose Kentavious Caldwell-Pope to Orlando. And they really haven't added much of anything anywhere near the impact of those three guys. But because of Nikola Jokic and to a lesser degree Jamal Murray, the expectations will stay really high. They won a championship 2 years ago. But just roster-wise, that's a play-in team to me. And I'm not even sure they'd be a play-in team without Nikola Jokic. They've got a good four-man core.
Yeah.
But, God, beyond that, they don't have another proven guy. I mean, Christian Brown, Peyton Watson. I mean, I don't know where they go with that group. Jokic will keep them afloat. Michael's an outstanding coach.
Yep.
One of the best in the league, and so they'll be solid every night, but they just have not been able to retain or replace key parts of their rotation. So I would say in the group, they all four have big challenges, but Michael probably has the biggest.
Mm-hmm. Coaches, by now you have seen the newest thing coming out of a pen and a napkin, the opening tip, Substack newsletter. I put an edition out there for free, and hopefully you see what a great investment this is going to be for you as a coach. I'm guessing it probably is, if you watch everything and listen to everything, it's going to take you almost 3 hours to get through everything on the opening tip newsletter here. What do we have in there? You've got an original article by myself here, just thoughts, ideas on different coaching topics. Into the Lab, that's probably my favorite thing. Is the Into the Lab. It's me, another coach, and a whiteboard, and we're just drawing stuff up here. Stuff to help you out, to help you become better, and to help your team become better this coming season and beyond. Got another exclusive podcast. You heard the first one, Industriousness from the Wooden Pyramid of Success. And it's me and it's two semi-retired former girls basketball coaches, Matt Kern of York, Nebraska, Nate Wall of David City Aquinas here in Nebraska. And every newsletter, we're going to break down an aspect of Wooden's Pyramid of Success. Bookshelf recommendations from off the bookshelf, X's and O's stuff. I'm dropping in a university video. It's just going to be given to you there, you know, and I really believe in the products that I've put together. It's practical stuff that's going to help make you a better coach. And then we've got the Coach's Corner with links to clips and articles. As you saw, we had our two Olympic coaches, Steve Kerr and Cheryl Reeve. Just really, really good stuff here. And I know it's subscription-based, but goodness gracious sakes alive, as Coach Wooden would say, it is so affordable. $8 a month. For two newsletters, that's $4 every newsletter. That's $2 every single week. Or you can get a year-long subscription, $75. That's 24 editions of the newsletter. That's basically $3 a newsletter. That's basically a dollar an hour if it takes you about 3 hours to get through everything that you're getting here. It could not be more affordable. It could not be more positive for you. It's going to help make you a better coach. So subscribe to the Opening Tip newsletter. Folks, you're not going to regret it. Stan, let's, if it's all right with you, if you got another, I don't know, 15 minutes or so, let's talk a little bit about your philosophy here. I want to dive in with that. Let's talk about your season. I think one of the great challenges we have as coaches is we have to win today, but we also have to think a week, a month, 5 months down the line. You know, you talked about the situation you had with Luke Kennard when you were in Detroit. How did you organize your season before the season? How did you look at it? Did you break it down in segments? You know, what did you do with your staff in that way? I mean, just how did you try to plan out? And obviously, most of the coaches that are going to be listening to this are high school coaches, so we don't have the 82-game gauntlet with 41 road games all over the country and doing things like that. So I really wanted to pick your brain about that. You know, just organizing your season, looking ahead. You know, what were you looking for progression and implementation? How did you put that all together?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Marty. Look, I think, and this is, I think, maybe different in the NBA, but is probably more applicable to high school coaches. The big thing with me is I wanted our guys to be ready to go out of the gate. I thought in the NBA, a lot of people, you see it again this year, won't play their main guys much in the preseason. Teams don't practice as much in the NBA. And so they've got to get 10, 15, 20 games into the season before they're at 100% in terms of conditioning and in terms of really executing well together and things like that. I always thought in the NBA, we could gain an advantage out of the block if we did more in training camp and in the preseason, played our guys more minutes in exhibition games. I thought that was the one point in the year where your conditioning and your readiness could make up for less talent than some of the opponents you played. So I wanted to be really, really ready to go out of the gate. Now, I think at the high school level, I think that's even more important. I think, you know, certainly you want to get better as the year goes on.
Yeah.
But man, I would be ready to go game one, because here's the other thing I think is in the NBA, you've got 82 games. So you're going to go through ups and downs. You know, you're going to go through 3-game, 4-game losing streaks, and a little bit of confidence will be lost. But you've got time to get them back and recover and things like that and go on a run. In high school, as you know, man, you lose,
it's a sprint,
3 or 4 in a row early. And because every year it's a new group, even if you brought back a lot of guys, every year is a new group. you lose three or four early and confidence wanes, and they're younger guys without as much experience, that whole season can go down the tube and you might have lost four games, close games.
Yep.
You know, you might not be that far away, but you're just fighting all year to get back. And yep. So I really think readiness at the start of the season, mm-hmm. what, you know, your preseason work, your conditioning, you know, getting your stuff installed, getting players to execute, figuring out who your best lineups are. I mean, we played in the NBA as my career went on. Every single year, we spent more time 5-on-5 in the preseason, even in our practices, than we did earlier in my career. I got to the point of saying, you know what? We've got to truly do whole part whole, and the whole part's got to be a big point. I mean, I wanted to be scrimmaging in the NBA, full out scrimmaging, referees, 48 minutes, you know, games, the whole thing on the first day of training camp. Get some stuff installed and let's go play. I think that's how you get conditioning. I also think that's how you get as a coach. That's how you evaluate your team.
Yeah.
If you're a guy who goes drill, 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 and now, you know, we're a week before the season and we start doing some 5-on-5 and stuff, man, it gets tough to evaluate your roster and who should be playing and everything else. And I think you've also, as a, you know, a little bit of a diversion with that as a coach at any level, but particularly at the high school level, you got to go into your seasons open-minded.
Yeah.
Kids change a lot from one year to the next. I think going into a season, I think that at the college level too, I've talked to some guys going into the season thinking you know who your best players are, I think you could be making a lot of mistakes if you don't go in with an open mind and go with the guys who perform best over time. You know, you get guys out there, you try different combinations. You might be surprised with who your better players are from year to year. And other guys, as you know, certainly happens in the NBA, but it happens even at the high school level. Certain guys stall out. Their development stalls. They were good as juniors. You think they're going to be really good as seniors. They're no better. But this other kid who was a sophomore and not ready to play, all of a sudden his body filled out. He worked on his game. He's a lot better. And as a coach, are you objective enough to see that? And do you have the guts enough to evaluate, you know, to elevate a guy above a guy who was above him the year before? I think that preseason time is really, really important, because if your team is ready and gets some wins early and gains some confidence early, then they can weather the tough times of the season and bounce back, keep improving, and get better at the end of the year. So to me, that was the biggest planning I did, is how are we going to be ready day one? Then you're troubleshooting the rest of the year. Then you're, you know, Dick Bennett had a great line. Best college coach that I ever saw for my money, Dick Bennett, Tony Bennett's dad, who was at Wisconsin Green Bay, took over for me after I got fired at Wisconsin. I have said, people think I'm joking. I'm not. I have said the single greatest, you know, elevation of a program of a head coach one over the other. I thought I was a pretty good coach. I'm not being overly modest or humble. I thought I did a good job. I really did. They thought what they thought, and there were some boosters involved, and the whole thing could have been a little bit better, would have been a little bit better, learned a lot. But Dick Bennett over Stan Van Gundy, tremendous. But when Dick got the job at Wisconsin, I was still living in Madison, and I went to meet with him. I had respected him greatly from afar. And I remember asking him about practice, and he said, I'm different from a lot of guys. And he said, I don't have like certain drills I like or a certain practice structure I like to do day to day. He said, I think what you have to do is watch your team and they'll tell you what they need to work on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's absolutely right. It sounds elementary, but I don't think many of us actually do it that way. And, you know, they could watch the game film and say, okay, these are the four things I've got to do today. I don't have a list of drills that I've got to get through or whatever. These are the things we need to hone in on. And so my thing was, we got to be ready for the season. And then we've got to work on the things that we need to work on from day to day during the year and make the adjustments we need to make. And that sounds simplistic, and it is. I'm sure there were other parts of it, but I think a lot of it to me was, can we be ready on day one?
Yeah. You know, you had said about the losing streaks, the three, you know, your 3-game losing streak, 4-game losing streak, and how at the high school level, I mean, that just from my own experiences, my last year at my first long-term head coaching spot, our pre-Christmas schedule was absolutely just loaded. Like if you were to pick 5 of the 7 best teams we were going to play all year, they were all before the holiday break. And I just kept telling people, hey, if we can get out of this I'll be tickled pink if we're 4-3 at Christmas. And there's a real possibility we're going to be 3-4. And we ended up going 2-5. And man, Stan, it was such a difficult lift to get those kids. I mean, and you tried to sit there and say, hey, look at who we've played, look at what we've done. A couple of plays here or there in these 2 games, we would have been just fine. So let's just keep it up. But like you said, you go on like a 1-3-game losing streak early in the year at the high school level, and that can really, really mentally deflate your team for the entire season.
Well, right. And I think even more so, Marty, if you're a younger coach, you know, you're a first or second year guy and you don't have a resume behind you where the kids and parents and your administrators all know, hey, this guy can really coach. You know, if you don't have that behind you and you get off to a slow start, now the kids don't believe, mm-hmm. you know, because they've got no foundation to believe. So I think being as ready as you can early in the year, and you know this a lot better than I do, but, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-old kids are a lot different even than NBA guys.
Yep.
You know, NBA guys, they've got their own successes behind them. And so while they might lose a little bit of confidence team-wise, you know, they're a little quicker to bounce back individually because they've got this record of success behind them. And I think, you know, at any level, though, being able to get your teams out of those tailspins is a challenge. And I think getting the focus back to what you need to do to that process, to the building blocks of winning, the specifics, rather than focusing on the result. Because listen, the other thing that's going to happen at any level, you're going to have some teams that are just overmatched. Like, yep. We're all going to have years. We're just not going to be very, very good. You don't say that to your team.
But you know, you don't have the Jills and the Joes.
Right. We're not going to be great. And I think what should stay consistent, the things that have to be done to build a good team, whatever those things are in your philosophy, for me, it was the defensive end of the floor, starting with transition and rebounding and not fouling, and the things that, you know, I felt like any team at any talent level could take care of. Those were our things. We're going to focus on those things, you know, and you've got to talk about those things, and you've got to show your team when they're improving in those areas. And hopefully they start to see more success, mm-hmm. You know, but I just think, again, it goes back to me, no matter what it is, have as much success as you can early in the year, because there's going to be some teams that maybe didn't put as much into it in terms of conditioning, in terms of their early season practice work and things like that. That's where you can get an advantage. By the time you hit midseason, everybody's in shape.
Yep.
You know, and now it becomes more of a talent thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you can steal some early and maybe gain some confidence. Maybe as a high school team, you pull an eye upset, even a minor one early, and kids go, oh, wow, like, you know, we're better than I thought we were going to be, and start believing. I think it's a huge part that's overlooked. When I listen to coaches talk, we always talk about getting better as the season progresses, want to be at your best at the end of the year. That's all true and important. I don't hear enough talk about, hey, let's be ready when that ball goes up on day one, because that's where we can really gain an advantage on somebody.
Mm-hmm. Let's go home on this here, Stan. Let's talk a little bit about how you organized your bench, how you organized your coaching staff. I know that's a key thing that coaches are thinking about going into the season here in the next month or two. What are some tips that you would have for coaches listening to this about what you did with your coaching staffs?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that, you know, I wanted my coaching staff very, very involved on a daily basis. And so we met as a staff before practice every morning so that they had input into what we needed to do in practice and specifically what needed to be corrected and worked on and things like that. I didn't want to just hand them a practice plan. Now, I know at the high school level, that's a little harder. You got guys who are teaching all day. You don't even see each other until 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yep.
You know, I know that's harder, but in the NBA, we wanted those guys involved. One of the things that I encouraged is for guys to write down thoughts. Give me your written thoughts. That's something you could do at the high school level. Like, you know, you may not see your assistant coach until before practice every day, and then you're both leaving to go home to family after. Hey, you know what? Next morning when you get to school, leave some notes on my desk or whatever, but I wanted them to have input. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
I've been on staffs where certain guys were given input, others weren't. It's hard for an assistant coach to be invested in what you're doing if they don't have that kind of input. Then in practice, and I do think this is important, regardless, and I think at the high school level, probably more than the NBA level, even though most NBA teams have cut back on practice, you have a finite amount of time in practice. And so us being efficient with our time, you know, choosing the right things to work on,
yep,
getting the most out of what we have to do is important, but also that we've really got our bases covered in practice. And so if we're doing, I think this is really important when you get away from small group work and you're doing 4-on-4 or 5-on-5 stuff. I think if you're not specific with your coaches on responsibilities, we can be running a great drill. Let's say we're doing shell defense and we've got this great drill. I might have in the NBA, all three of my assistants might end up looking at the same guy. And so we've got our center covered. Everybody's looking at him, and we're not looking for all these other things. So when we talked about what we needed to do, we would also talk about responsibilities, and it would be right on the practice plan. So we're doing shell defense. You know, Bob, you've got defensive rebounding block out.
Mm-hmm.
That's what. Now, you might notice every other thing. I wasn't saying guys couldn't comment, but if guys aren't blocking out, that's on you. Like, I want to hit that every time. Charles, you might have guys are getting back on the release of the shot. You know, somebody else might have ball pressure and hand activity. So that we're, the areas we identified when we were coming up with the practice plan were areas that I knew were going to be focused on by somebody on the staff.
Yep.
I thought that was really, really important with coaches. We would do the same thing to a degree in game. Now, I will say for my top guy, the guy that was going to give me the most input in the game, I didn't want him to have specific responsibilities. I wanted him to watch the game, offense, defense, all 10 guys. Just like I did.
Yep.
And to be able to comment to me on anything. But with some of the other guys, and I would say if you have younger, lesser experienced guys, one of the hardest things to do in coaching, you know, to me, in my own evolution, is when you're first starting out, it's hard to even see one full team of five guys. You're probably focusing on one or two guys. And eventually, I can see my team, which is fine. But I think that you gain experience and get better as a coach, particularly in practice, you get to where you can see all 10 guys.
Yep.
And I don't think younger coaches have that. And so for them to truly be able to make a contribution on the bench in a game, you can give them a specific area. Mm-hmm. Might be something you're really concerned about. We haven't been doing a good job of getting back defensively. Yeah. Our guys maybe haven't been doing a good job of running either to the rim or all the way to the deep corner on offense. Maybe they've been stopping short. Hey, you know, make sure you're seeing that as you go, so that everybody feels like and truly is involved in the game and making an important contribution. But it's got to be within their abilities. And just like with players, you're going to give those coaches a chance over time from season to season to improve and take on more responsibility. But I think this happens in player development, and it certainly happens in coach development as well. Giving people responsibility that they're not ready for, that exceed their experience level. I won't say their ability level,
sure,
but their experience level,
yep,
leads to a loss of confidence. Not only do they not have as much confidence, but you don't have confidence in them as a coach, because what they're telling you is either wrong or not of value. And if you could have pared down their responsibility, and they're saying, you know, like you might give a coach and say, hey, focus in on what their guys off the ball are doing on pick and roll. You know, that's a little bit even more advanced. Hey, coach, they're really staying spread out to taking away the three. Okay, now we know we can beat them on the interior. You know, things like that. And now you can, you know, make adjustments better, give that guy credit for them. Now the confidence grows, your confidence in that coach grows. But as a head coach, I think you've got to give people specific responsibilities that fit their experience level and their ability.
Yeah. Awesome, Stan. Just so much good stuff here this afternoon. It has been a privilege and a pleasure to get to know you a little bit the last few months, to get to know your dad a little bit. I just want to thank you so much for your time. If folks want to get a hold of you, how would they reach out to you if they want to follow you on social media? Where's all that stuff?
I'm not on social media. You know, I'm not. I think the better thing, Marty, to be honest, because I'm also pretty involved politically and with some charitable stuff. So I'm not exaggerating, get 350 to 400 emails a day. And I tend to search for my kids and my family and not get to some of the things I should get to. I'd be better off if they went through you and you could pass them on to the ones that you think, you know, would be worthy to pass on. And I don't do that. I've stopped giving out my email because I did it and then didn't get back to some people and felt awful about that.
Okay.
And I just said, hey, I'm not able to keep up with that now, especially since my wife has passed. I got too much else going on. So I'm certainly willing to help, but I'll let you be the gatekeeper.
Oh, God, that's a lot of responsibility, Stan. I don't know.
But it's a lot less responsibility for me, Marty, and so I like that. I can delegate that to you. I don't have anyone else to delegate to.
And we know who the head coach has been for a long time, who is delegating the responsibilities there. So
that's exactly right.
So I tell you what, folks, if you've got questions for Coach Van Gundy, reach out to me. You know how to get a hold of me, and we'll do that there. Stan, can't thank you enough for your time here. I hope you had a good time on A Pen and a Napkin.
I really enjoyed it, Marty. Always good to talk basketball, and I wish all the coaches listening, including yourself, successful and enjoyable season.
Absolutely. If you can hold the line a second here, Stan, just got to wrap up a couple things. Again, NBA head coach, former NBA head coach, current announcer with the league, Stan Van Gundy. So many really, really good things that Coach went through here today. We, of course, want to thank our founding sponsor. Again, this is our five-year anniversary pod. None of this would have been possible without COSAC Chiropractic. Dr. Kevin, Dr. Heidi, just can't thank them enough. So if you are in need of a chiropractor in the Omaha area, please go check out Dr. Kevin, Dr. Heidi. Follow us on Twitter at A Pen and a Napkin. Download, rate, review this. Give us 5 stars. Like I said, if you want to reach out to Coach, if you have questions for Coach Van Gundy, email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. It's been a crazy 5 years. I can't thank everybody enough. And this has just been an awesome way to celebrate it. So here's to 5 years, and here's to hopefully 5 more years, the good Lord willing. So coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.